You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
It's just me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my guest, Andrew Brown, president of Bridgemaker Referral Programs. How are you doing today, Andrew?
I am exceptional, Sam. How are you?
Fantastic. Good, good. I'm exceptional as well. I've got, like we were talking about a little bit before it started, lots of highs and lows this last month, but that inner peace can be consistent if you let it and nurture it.
If you can have inner peace while the world is going crazy around, that speaks volumes to you and your support system, right? Because part of that inner peace comes from knowing that people around you are supportive and can pick up the pieces or provide that additional structure. So good on you.
No kidding. No kidding. So you and I connected over LinkedIn. It's funny, for those listening, I feel like at some point we're going to have to be LinkedIn sponsored with just as much close connections that have happened over LinkedIn. And you're a published author. You've got a few good books on the market here, and I think a new one recently out.
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that. Yes. Over the years, I've written a number of books about how to really optimize business relationships with the goal of helping companies grow. So I had a book on how to set up strategic alliances, like a playbook on how to do that, a playbook on how to use channel resellers effectively. And my latest book is the one that made number one Amazon bestseller. Is on how to systematically harness the unique power of referral source.
That's fantastic. That's really amazing. And considering your background, I would say you're a man of the book, it seems.
I like to think so. But, you know, for over 30 years, I've worked in professional services, financial services, software as a service, digital marketing agencies, and really helping grow companies by increasing revenue. And that's meant I've had executive marketing, communication, business development, and sales positions. And during that time, I wrote a lot of articles for publications, major publications across Canada and North America on how to leverage relationships. And I consistently found that good quality leads, which everybody wants, were coming in via trusted referral source. And that was happening in parallel to well set up, established sales and marketing initiatives. So while organizations were building these great infrastructures, budgets, and content, right? Content, once you start down that content road, you feel like you can never stop it, to deploy these digital tools, when it came to selling big ticket, profitable, predictable, or rather big ticket items and getting profitable and predictable revenues, all that was secondary. Mm. And I found the way that organizations actually used referrals or leveraged them had real negative consequences. Like referral sources were being overused, they were being neglected and disrespected. And so, I mean, that's huge, right? We all know how important referral sources can be. So businesses lost existing customers, experienced reputational damage when referral sources weren't representing a business well. They alienated referral sources and lost what had been, you know, really, truly high-value leads. And I knew there had to be a better way. There had to be a way. Harnessing referral sources' energies and their enthusiasm while avoiding the potential downsides. So while I was working inside these organizations across industries, selling big ticket products and services, I was refining a game-changing way to systematically tap into the energies and talents of referral sources. So when you say, I'm very much About the book, yes, I'm passionate. I can't stand waste. I love to help organizations grow and to tap into the enthusiasm of people who start businesses, run businesses, want to improve businesses. Because what are businesses? They are reflections of ourselves, right? They're little social microcosms, right? There are families, families that help generate value, sell things, make money, bring a satisfaction to us individually, help build the community. So organizations are really important, and I really want to help organizations succeed. And leveraging referrals in a systematic way is my way of doing that.
That's fantastic. So you hinted that in there too, and something we haven't quite touched on yet. Mm. Tell us where you're from for the audience.
Oh, how to tackle this? So I'm based north of Toronto. I've lived a large portion of my life in Toronto, but I did some of my studies in the UK, in the US, and in Scandinavian countries as well. And these were all sort of my post-grad studies when it came to helping understand how organizations work. And so that's where I am geographically, and that's sort of gives you a sense of my internationality. But tell me, what else do you want to know about my background?
Because I think you nailed it. Because what I'd like to kind of get to at kind of a deeper level. You mentioned internationality, and you and I have connected. So I'm in Kansas City, Missouri. So you throw a dart at the map, right? And if you hit bullseye, you pretty much nailed our city. And we've connected over such swath, a large geographical area, and I think. Sometimes, depending on the circles I'm in, it's been said before, you know, hey, how the heck do you know someone in? How the heck do you know someone in? And I mean, to kind of even maybe circle back to your whole get referred notion and what we're basically talking about is just connecting as human beings, right, on planet Earth via good conversation, right? Good. Genuine conversation such that it doesn't matter if we're on a Zoom or miles apart, hundreds of miles apart.
Yeah. Good conversation, as you say, transcends geographies. And how we know, how people get to know one another, of course, has expanded. I mean, we know that social media has availed people of new opportunities. The downside of social media, I actually sometimes call it the anti-social media, because yes, you might be connecting with someone, but the type of connection, the depth of that connection, the kinds of conversations you have aren't necessarily social, not unless you really use a broad term or broad definition of social, meaning just two people getting together, right? I mean, that's social. But if we're talking about deep interaction and when I think about get referred it's very much about trust. And there are a number of different types of trust. And when it comes to referring, forgive me if I'm pulling back to my area of domain expertise, when it comes to referring high-value products and services, people put their business and reputational, their business and personal reputations on the line. So they've got to have trust. They've got to have trust that the people that they're bringing to a company or an organization has competence and also cares enough about the delivering the good service and product. And so those two kinds of trust, years ago, I discovered a model of trust that is always in the back of my head. And it's a great one for your thousands of of your loyal listeners. It's, I believe, Richard Beckert's model of trust. It's A, B, C, and D. And in order to build trust, you've got to have and A, B, C, D is not an acronym, but it speaks to the first letter of each of the three components. So there's ability or competence. That's A. B, believability.
Okay.
C is caring, and D is delivering. And in order for an individual, a group, an organization to establish and nurture and maintain that trust, they've got to be able to do those three things: demonstrate competence, be believable, care. And that's sometimes difficult for some organizations if they're only thinking about transactional relationships and deliverability. So deliverability, dependability, pardon me, D is dependability. So I encourage anyone that really knows that it's important for their individual success or their brand success to be built on a foundation of trust. Take a look at that very simple model and ask yourself, what have we done today or what are we planning to do to demonstrate to people that are important to us that we are trustworthy?
You know, and that's fantastic. And it's dependability, not deliverability,
yeah,
correct?
Thank you. Ooh, okay. You're fast on the Google search. Good.
Well, I asked, you corrected yourself, which is, but the reason I asked, I mean, you could have sold me on deliverability, but dependability, it tweaks things, right? Because it's that company that, and you know, I'll come out and say we've made mistakes as a company. And I think it deepens the relationship in some cases because the number one thing that you as a vendor partner relationship want to know is, are you going to make it right? Like in the same sort of way, my vendors have made mistakes, and I almost kind of get excited a little bit because it's like, I mean, nobody likes mistakes, but on the same token, it's an opportunity to see how are they going to handle that.
Exactly. I remember, and again, this will tap into the student of me, but years ago, I remember seeing studies by Harvard that said that that you could actually, I'm not suggesting that people do this, but you can go into engagement and purposely make a mistake, purposely, deliberately, with intent, and then remedy it. And doing so will demonstrate to the folks that you care enough about them. There's that C, that caring component. You know, you talk about making it right. Isn't just about showing competence. It's that you care enough about your client's success that you will provide a remedy. Now, I take issue with that study because, yes, you can do that. Right? You can go when you make a mistake and then you can show how wonderful you are by remedying it. But are you being disingenuous
at
going in and intentionally making an error? So, and I'm not sure that's great for the brand if the very first experience or an early experience someone has with you is a tumultuous one or a negative one. I mean, as you say, when vendors mess up, it is a window into their organization, into their true value. Not necessarily their espoused values of what's on their website or what they used in the sales pitch, but their true values as to how they're going to behave. And so I agree with you. When that happens, you sit back and see how do they get defensive? Do they think it's a personal attack on them? Or do they stop and they say, well, wait a sec, we've had, not only do we have a business contract, but we have a social contract with our clients, right?
Yeah.
That we will behave in a particular way. We will be decent to one another. We will listen to one another. And different organizations based, again, on their values, some will go, we got to step up here. We made a boo-boo. And that's okay. We're humans. Humans create organizations and processes. Well, because we're imperfect, our processes and our organizations are going to be imperfect as well.
When I like how you say true values, you know, you get an opportunity to find out their true values, because it's that difference between inspirational values, right? This is what we say we do versus this is what we actually do when the chips are down.
Go ahead.
No, you're good. So I was going to flip the script on you a little bit, if you don't mind.
Not at all.
So if we were to kind of rewind the clock, so to speak, let's turn the proverbial time machine dial and place Andrew in kind of the sort of high school period. And I think you and I have had this conversation. High school is relatively similar in Canada, just maybe a little bit different, but similar enough that the analogy still applies. Your age, you know, 16, 17, and 18, let's say.
Yeah.
And the world, you've got your parents and your friends and those around you. The world has this opinion of what Andrew maybe should or shouldn't be, or they're looking at you, Andrew, and they're saying, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? What does Andrew think he's going to do with his life at this age?
At 18, I was on a very different career trajectory. And so I'm an anomaly, probably. And yet I suspect when I think about it, people do come out of high school and go in different directions, right? Than they had perceived. So when I left high school, I was a full-blown music freak. And I knew that there were other musicians out there that inspired me and intrigued me. And so I was just a sponge for music. And I wanted to be a studio musician. And so I was studying like gangbusters, practicing guitar, piano. I also played flute, trumpet, violin, viola, cello. I was very much about learning more about different types of music. And I got into a car accident just after high school. And it meant that I could no longer sit down and practice the required number of hours in order to succeed at being a studio musician. So that was heartbreaking. And for a little while, I kind of was in denial. Right? How can I not do this? And yet, I was fortunate because I had a good support system, and they were encouraging and saying, "Yeah, okay, you know, you can hold out until you're better, or maybe you need to explore other things." And I went back to university. I went back to undergrad university, and the experience of learning something again was just mind-blowing. I was just little while that I had out of high school, about 18 months, 2 years, just got me really hyped on learning again. And so, and I threw myself into what was at the time a very, in Canada's universities, a relatively new area of study, which was organizational development, organizational design, organizational behavior. That's all those three areas combined. And I remember going to a class that started off, you know, it had, and this was, wasn't even in a business program yet, but it was more in social, a social program, because again, organizations are social things that we construct. And this class was on structuring organizations. How do you put together an organization and make it function? And there were 400 people in this class. And when the class ended, there were four of us, because it just challenged a lot of people. One of the books behind that was at the core of it was Henry Mintzberg, who is sort of this father of organizational structuring. Years later, I got a chance to meet him and realized he was a good academic, but not a great practitioner. He had actually never run a business, which I thought was mind-blowing. But what did I know when I came back to school? So organizational studies and understanding that organizations operate differently. There are individuals, we interact one-on-one, we have our own skills, our own behaviors, and then there are group dynamics, right? Once we get into groups, the group behaves differently. It can take on a mind of its own, and people adopt different roles within the group. And then there are the organization dynamics. So this really intrigued me, and I was just swept in to the world of understanding how organizations.
Okay, so there's an element in there I'd really love to sort of boil to the surface,
because sure.
you talked about, you know, you met the gentleman that sort of curated this thing and found out that he hadn't necessarily built an organization himself. He was more of a bit of an academic type, like
yes.
you talk. And I want to get into this a little bit more from multiple yeah. angles. And it's not, in my mind, it's not even that it's good or bad. It is what it is.
Sure.
But it's because I've noticed in myself, even just as an entrepreneur, early on, I felt like I needed to read all these books, which I think are very significant. And I am a fan of, you know, a lot of everything I know. Basically, it comes back to our motto, is more or less attributable to books or mentors or people mm-hmm. around me. That said, it is kind of interesting in that if you're not careful, you can kind of get sucked into this vortex of like constantly learning and theorizing and never actually going out and putting into practice.
Yeah.
The other aspect, so here's kind of the question, more of like an opinion. So the other aspect is, I think you can observe and get the logos of an organization, right? By like, look, this is how we all operate as people. This is the sort of hierarchical structure. Do you think that is sufficient? Or is there something to also embodying, say, the ethos and having that person that's like, you know, I may not understand the logos. I may not understand, you know, okay, well, all right, great example. You know, maybe we just pulled Steve Jobs, right? And we're like, hey, we want you to sort of break down why Apple succeeded as an organization. We don't care about the iPhone. We don't care about we want to know the success behind the organization and the structure. I wonder, and admittedly, I haven't read a ton of his books, but I wonder if Steve Jobs could actually answer that question. And if it would almost be more of like, he might come up with an answer, but has he really like thought of the depth of like, this is our management style and this is our versus, I think he just kind of tackled the idea and the day and and somehow it all kind of came together. Anyway, okay, so the question.
Yeah.
In academics.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a significant value to academic professors that have the logos, but maybe not the ethos, let's say? Should there be a priority? Should we have both? Is there a world where in those classes we also bring in business owners and say, hey, we need you to present so we can get your take?
So I found, and I'll tell you why, what it was about Mintzberg at the time that was particularly compelling. Yes, it was a difficult topic area to wrap your head around. But what it did was his book and academia at large provides a structure, a way of exploring, a way of asking questions, topics that should be considered, a way to help you determine your priorities. It doesn't necessarily say these are the things that are more important, but it helps you judge for yourself how you're going to determine your priorities. So that grounding is valuable, because then when you go out into the world or you're speaking to people who are running businesses successful or have bungled it, right? Sometimes you learn a lot by your mistakes. That kind of structure helps you inquire, helps you get a deeper understanding rather than going to someone, to an organization and say, why are you so successful, or why did this not work? You've got to tease it out. You need that structure. You make a bunch of assumptions, and you need also, that's something else that good academics should do, is question some of the assumptions, because things that we assume for years or decades may have been built on a reality from years ago with different technological advancements, different cultural values. So again, academia should provide that grounding when it comes to courses. But let me speak about books first, because I used to be a voracious reader of books, and I still read books fairly frequently. I always have two or three on the go. When it comes to business books, I have been, can I say pissed?
You can. Okay. Yes. Yes. Pissed.
We can go
the full extreme with the our vocabulary here.
Okay, excellent. So I was always pissed when people would have put out business books, and they would have one single idea, and then there would be analogies and stories, metaphors and all sorts of things. And you just spent $35 on a business book, and it was one idea. I hated that. I felt that was the ultimate disrespect for readers.
I call it a self-help book. Which is upsetting. There's probably self-help books that are actually helpful, but even the business ones, they all embody this kind of similar sort of model. I have it like a 5-part model in my head. I'm going to show you the thing. This is the thing and how it's rocked people's world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the thing, right? Chapter 5, right? You're halfway through the book and you finally get the thing, which is like, visualize yourself being successful like Michael Phelps did, right?
Right.
And then the last two parts are testimonials of people that have applied the thing and, you know, the fact that the world was changed because of the thing. But to your point, exactly, it pisses me off too. It's a far cry from How to Win Friends and Influence People that is like thing after thing, well curated.
Exactly. And so, by the way, that's why I was so determined, particularly with Get Referred, How to Increase Sales, Velocity, Volume, Value. I wanted to make sure that this was going to be immediately actionable, tremendously practical. I wanted people, in fact, in the book itself, each section says how long you will have to read before you can actually apply something. It actually gives that time, as well as how long it takes to get through the chapter. There are how-tos in the book, summaries, next steps, key points, key takeaways. And the reason being, and it's laid out, it's best in the physical format than the digital, because I worked with a designer and layout specialist, but it is meant to be used, meant to help people do something, have an impact, have a positive impact. And so I, again, to me, it's a matter of respect for the audience, respect for the readers. And it's a disrespect to give them fluff. It's a disrespect to give them a promise and not fulfill it. And, when it comes to academic books versus business books, that's actually where there's a bit of a flip. Business books tend to have that one idea and a whole bunch of fluff. Academic books are the reverse, ironically, right? It's a lot of stuff in there and a little fluff. They can be really difficult to read, and I don't spend a lot of time on academic books.
Yes, almost like a series of white papers.
Yes.
Kind of.
Exactly. I mean, there's some great learnings. And if you know what you're looking for, again, this comes back to the discipline that should be applied when building a business or tackling a project. It's having a method of inquiry knowing what to ask, knowing how to prioritize and weigh different data. That's what academia should give you. It should give you those foundations, the groundings, underpinnings. And then you bring in someone in business, whether it's Steve Jobs or anyone else, you then have a bit of that, the lexicon, the vocabulary to ask the right questions, tease out things, identify when there's a little bit of fudging going on. And then that learning helps provide you with the basis to build, grow, or hone your business.
Interesting. Okay, so I have two kind of key questions from here, and I think one will take longer than the other. So we'll start with what I think could be the shorter one.
Okay.
Do you think that is what academia is currently? I agree with you that university should be that, almost sort of like a test tube. Frankly, if I'm being honest, I romanticize that notion in general, because I think, man, if I could do anything, the notion of going back to university as a test tube to you know, come up with ideas. And because I'm a big fan of random ideas and thoughts, and what if the world ran like this, you know what I mean? But I worry that's not what university is currently, nor was that maybe what university was, or at least the one I went to when I went to university. So the question I pose is, do you think that's still what university is? Do you think that's what university ever was?
A couple things. So first, it's tough to, and we've talked, you know, largely in some generalizations, right? We talk about academia, right? So we're bucking everything in from.
Oh yeah, academia. We're not picking on any particular university, right. More right. Of like a philosophy,
right?
And right. The question of whether or not we think worldwide university in the main as a philosophy is in practice what you stated it should be.
So agreed. But an academia starts also, you know, nursery school, public school, like it's academia.
Yes.
Starts from,
yes.
Right, from, and goes all the way into postgraduate. And if we're ongoing learners, we set up other structures that might not be called universities, but like learning annexes and meetup groups, right? This is all part of academia.
1,000%. Right?
So
yes.
It is a pretty big bubble. So it's hard to say.
Okay, then I need to refine it a little bit more, because if we include that, then I'm definitely still in academia. So
sure. You're still a learner. You should all be learners.
Yes.
Right?
So then to refine this more, the question was, do you think the formal education system that we have currently, and I guess we in this case, we're going to pick on Canada a little bit more because geographically that's where you're at and that's what you're more familiar with. Do you think, you know, the early into high school into college, do you think it is the best version or even a good version of what you're saying, which is this sort of test tube for curious individuals to learn these structures, to test and question these structures, and then to go out into the world to business owners and say, I think this is how it's supposed to work.
Okay. Thank you for refining that. And then again, I'm not going to be I have a narrow lens, right? One person. Now,
yes.
I do lecture at a few different universities.
Yes.
That's part of my contributing to the ongoing wellness of our society. I believe if we have good learning institutions, we all benefit. So I do that.
And I try to do similar as well. I've had the pleasure of being invited to one or two, which is always a nice reminder of, there was even one relatively recently that was like, I don't have a college degree. And they were like, I would love for you to talk. And I'm like,
awesome.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Awesome.
Cause they're like, I want people to see the breadth of availability to them.
So let me answer that in a couple of different ways. One is from a, product marketing.
Okay.
And products generally are as innovative as the market demands, right? So an organization will be chugging away offering services and products. It's only when the market says, hey, we'd like this additional functionality, or can we add these kinds of features? That's what drives most of the innovation within products and services in organizations. Now, good organizations also are monitoring, right? And they're bringing their own ideas, their own insights on top of that. But largely, it's in response to or anticipation of market articulation of their needs, of their problems they're going through. Now, if we see that, and then we think about who is the market at universities, right? Who is the paying customer? Now, it should be the students. I would argue that the students are the ones who pony up the money. It might be parents of the students, but it's the kids, the students who are compelling universities to innovate.
Okay.
Those universities who respond to that, I would say, are probably serving their organizations or serving their clients better.
Okay. Yes. But all right.
At the same time, if you have an ill-informed and not demanding market, you might ask, well, you know, on my car, can you make my cup holder bigger, right? It's not true innovation that's happening at the product level, and the universities can get away because all the students want was a larger, the academic equivalent to a larger cup holder. So what I found is that adult education is where things break off, where things splinter. I was very fortunate when I finished my undergrad, and then I had the car accident. I worked a little bit. I was managing a restaurant of 100 people. And so that when I went back to university, I had different kinds of questions. I was more demanding. I did not take it when a university professor would say something that was unreasonable or treat students like peons. I was more adult. I was only a couple of years older, but at adult education, those programs that aim to understand that that's a different segment, people's brains and experiences are at a different level. That's the segment of universities that I think are that we spoke about. Again, not ideally, they're still imperfect, right? But I think they are, there is that segment that does that. The lion's share, the undergrad work, and even perhaps even to some of that grad work where it's preformed, agendas what's the word I'm looking for? Curricula. Right?
Curriculum, yes.
It does not change. And there's a huge, by the way, there is, like that for an MBA programs are fairly standard. And in order to get MBA programs to truly change, there's a whole mechanism because MBAs are internationally recognized, right, as being pretty much equivalent, some cultural or local nuances, but there's a standard. So in order to get that standard curricular change is a monumental task. It's not usually driven by students because students coming into MBA programs are, again, that kind of more naive, uninformed, don't have the experience. They don't know until 7 or 8 years after they've done the MBA. They go, wait a second, the stuff I learned in the MBA in terms of content, again, it should have provide foundation, but a lot of the stuff is inaccurate, informed, just not adaptable. So again, splinter off the lion's share of education versus adult education. I would encourage people, again, I'm like you, I'm an ongoing learner. I think that people should periodically go and take courses and be exposed to the ideas, but bring with them their experience slash skepticism, their ability to probe, their perhaps more wisdom about how to work in groups, and bring that to the university. So I think universities can do that. There are places, again, I call that splinter between the mainstream and the continuing education or adult education. I think there's a splinter there. I'd like to think that some of those people, and that's one of the reasons why I lecture at undergrad levels, because I try to bring that reality. I do a course on how to, not surprisingly, how to increase revenues in organizations. I do that at university, and I go in there, and I often completely disrupt and make uncomfortable the students, because I say things like, all that stuff you talk about marketing is great, right? But you're talking about the using of tools. That's really not going to move an important business needle. I mean, it might on, and depending on how they're deployed and the strategy behind
it. Yes.
But I find myself in classes with people who have been spoon-fed things. And again, I understand that. Again,
yeah.
I've also created courses. I'm going to age myself. I developed the first university course in Canada on e-commerce. And
so
I understand the pressures it is to create a course that can then be reused, because you got to test people on it, right?
Yeah.
You got to evaluate people. And these are minds that are molding their varying degrees of interest and skills, and they've got hormones going crazy, right? I mean,
I want it
with something that is repeatable.
Yes.
Having said that, I really find it that there's a disservice if there isn't that questioning. And again, it's questioning the assumptions, questioning the processes, but the students need to do it.
Students
need to do it. And the addition, so back to earlier point when we're talking about bringing in different logos, yes, I think it's really valuable to bring in people who can reflect and say, you know, what you've got here, you know, 20% of that is on the mark. This 80%, nah, you need to rethink that. You need to rethink that. I think that is a duty of people who are enthusiastic, curious, want to be involved in community development. I think that's our duty. And I didn't mean to go on a rant about academia. I don't know how we got here.
it was fantastic. And I feel like there was a significant degree, if not all, you can kind of tell. I mean, there is some truth that is easy, but it seems rare. And I mean, like 2 + 2 = 4 might be like the only immediate example I can kind of come to. But in most cases, truth requires a significant degree of nuance, which I feel like you handled beautifully. So if I was to attempt to summarize, obviously you have these programs that are more stringent, such as the MBA program, that you can't really change that. And people entering into that should be under the impression that there is a almost semi-universal box, for lack of any better term. Part of the value of entering into the program is that you're entering into the box. Now, maybe later you'll flip the box around, and that's fantastic. But in the main, things are probably going to be pretty set in stone.
These are the books that we.
And then continuing education, adult learning, where that excels most and is obviously going to vary by class, but not just university, but also classroom,
mm-hmm.
Does the teacher have the investment to bring in external voices? And does the student have the investment to say, you know, hey, I think it would be nice to see somebody that's done this thing. Or,
yeah,
you know, you seem pretty hard set on this tool, but what about this tool. And to give credit to your statement too about you go into classrooms and organizations sometimes and flip their thinking upside down because sometimes there's too much investment on the tool. That's the bit that I've kind of found interesting for me, because especially in like tech, and especially in tech organizations, some of them are like almost apostolistic, or they proselytize about the tool that they use. But what I've found most effective, at least for me and for us, is it's like we could almost get by with any tool. I mean, we don't want to use a screwdriver to nail a nail in the wall, but you know, you don't necessarily need the most expensive hammer as long as you have a process and everybody understands how to use the hammer effectively.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm going to build on that. And thank you. You did summarize things very, very nicely. So the tool for tool's sake kind of mentality, I don't blame people for that. But let's go back to 2008. I had more hair, not quite as much wisdom. My waist was a little friendlier. And there were 150 sales and marketing digital tools out there. 150. There are 14,000 now, plus AI. So what's happened in that 17/18 years is that we've created a cohort, a generation of people who are a bit more focused on the technology than they are on the outcomes. There's also a self-reinforcing and justification loop that goes on. I think I said earlier about getting on the content wheel, right? Everyone knows once you start throwing content on the web, there's something that goes on in the brains or in the organizations. Oh, we've got to continue to do that. Got it, right? We bought into that. I liken it to when the first Ford car came off the assembly line. Got a car. Great. So we need a car industry. Okay, in order to create more. We got to create highways, right? So now you have an entire industry around all that's involved in creating highways, roads, and so all the mining related to that. Oh, well, hold on. So we need lights on the highway. Oh, okay. So there's an industry about illumination. And then, oh, we got to get hotels. Oh, okay. You'll say motels along the route. And, oh, well, you know, we got to build cities out there as well. We got this great car. So we start with this technology and then we start taking it for granted that always has to be the foundation of going from point A in a car, a point A to point B. In digital marketing, it was very, very similar. We created a whole bunch of tools, great innovation going on, great intention, often driven by engineers who didn't necessarily understand the business, but they could build a functioning product and then businesses would adapt to them. And so we created a whole bunch of technologies. Oh, you know, we got Google. Okay, well, then we got to set up SEO, right? We need that. Then there's an entire industry built on SEO. Oh, well, if you've got SEO, well, we're talking about content. There's an entire industry built on content, and all these feed one another. And from an organizational standpoint, if I put on my org hat, I really shouldn't be focused on content. I shouldn't be focused on SEO. I should be focused on growth of the company, growth of the individuals within the company, growth within the community. I should be focused on growth.
I agree. I would be, it's disruptive and interesting. You know, I would love to see a study on the typical entrepreneur or business owner and diagnosed ADHD. My guess is it's relatively disproportionate. And when you're trying to grow your business And what's worse is, you know, everybody kind of, we all kind of want a magic wand, right? So it's like, okay, well, we need to do advertising. And it's like, well, what kind of advertising? It's like, all of it. It's like, well, what's all of it? It's like billboards, Facebook ads. To your point, you can pay Google. Google will pop you to the top of SEO. And then it's like, okay, well, now we need these landing pages. And you're right, content, like the moment you start putting stuff out there, it's like, well, okay, what happens when you shut that off and now all of a sudden your feed is dead? Like, what does the world think when the feed dies? Yeah.
So it
gives credit to building things meaningful, you know,
yes,
a meaningful facet, which chimes back to the social media. I'd love to dive in a little bit more on this because we didn't quite get to it the way I was. You and I, in a world where you're right, there's the dark side of social media, which is siloed and endless content that isn't really genuine. And I like to think there's a bit of a resurgence, or at least the algorithms kind of figured out I'm naturally attracted to longer form or short form clips from longer form that are just a bit more deep and meaningful, real human experiences. How do we, and I'm trying to think of how to ask this question because it gives kind of credit to your entire program. How does one kind of start the process? And this is, I'm asking this not just as applicable to businesses, but applicable to people. How does one start the process of almost like coming out of the dark side, we'll say, into the notion of like, no, you can connect with Andrew directly over LinkedIn. You can message him and he may or may not message back, but that's going to be much more deep and meaningful than, a post to the proverbial masses that may or may not be received at all.
So I think it starts with, I don't want to say enlightened because that's not right, but maybe it's focus, it's intention, it's wanting to achieve something in particular and not getting bogged down on instantly saying that everyone else does it this way, so we should jump on the bandwagon without, and then getting that original intention lost. So when I speak to organizations, not surprisingly, I mean, we guarantee at Bridgemaker referral programs, that's named the company, we follow the methodology and get referred because it's tried and true and had been for 30 plus years across industries. We focus in on something that's really imperative to an organization. You want to achieve growth, and growth for you means revenue. There are different ways of measuring growth, but it is intentional. Once we have that discussion with an organization, they say, yeah, we really want to focus. I mean, reputation management is awesome and needs to be done. Retention, awesome, needs to be done. Product innovation, awesome, needs to be done. But when we speak to clients, we only work with organizations that want to have 25% annual revenue growth year over year. We want to work with ambitious organizations. And the reason is because there's a focus. And that focus is on growth as measured. And that degree of intentionality gets you to throw out, well, wait a sec, you know, we've done this before, but maybe that's not getting us what we want to. Our competitors are doing this. It's not getting them what they want. Historically, we've seen people or we've tried this. That's not getting what we want. And so I think the first plank that has to be put down when it comes to being dissuaded or not being sucked into that social media or the digital marketing or the normal way of doing, I think it's to stop and say, what are we really trying to achieve? And when you're leading an organization or you're leading an organization's growth, you should have the bandwidth to actually step back, ask that question, take a look at other methods. Are you saying, are we still just growing incrementally 1% or 0.25% per year? Is that what we want? Is that going to give us what we need in order to meet our aspirations of helping the community and serving our employees well and our shareholders well, or our own desire to retire, or whatever, right? Is that kind of growth? So is that kind of growth going to give us that? And so when we have these discussions with business owners and heads of sales and head of business development and head of marketing, when we get rid of the clutter, because I go in and ask, we ask them, what is it that you want? What is it that you do? And once we get on the table everything they do, we say, that's not getting you what you want. How about this? Can we make some assumptions? Can we boil it down to what's really important to you? It's really important to you. We talked earlier about values, organizations. It's all about values. I generally short form organizational culture by saying, what do you hire for? What do you fire for? What do you promote for? Those are, when you can answer those questions, that tells you what you really value.
Yeah.
And so when you have that intention, that clarity, then that really helps to say, oh, well, we don't have to do it that way. We don't have to do digital marketing campaigns like we have in the past. That's just moving the needle a little bit. And it's costing. Acquisition costs are going through the roof because you have to set up infrastructure and you're buying new content and you're investing in new technologies. You got to train people on new tools. Acquisition costs for clients through the roof. But what do you want? Do you want to build up, in some organizations, fine, they want to build up fiefdoms because someone there has that emotional need. You know, organizations are hotbeds of emotions, right? It's not all just black, you know, it's black and white, right? It's not just the bottom line. There are emotional people in organizations, or rather we are emotional beings, can't avoid it. So when we step back and we say, let's agree on the end point, what we measure success, what is truly important to us. And that paves the way for that clarity and hopefully avoids. I mean, there will be people that will occasionally be sucked back in, right? And there'll be times that, brand new shiny object. Oh, we should try this. Or brand new people coming on board and they'll go, I've always done it like this. And it's just a slight modification of what an organization's already been doing. It hasn't been transformational. It's not a true paradigm shift. It's not going to really do anything more than incremental change. And in fact, organizations have started to believe that incremental change is the only way that they can grow. We were blown away with one of our clients recently, and they actually said this to us. They said, Andrew, yours is the closest thing we've ever seen to a silver bullet. And I've never really liked that analogy, but I understand why they used it. Because when we come in, I mean, silver bullet, what does that convey? Well, speed. Right? Silver bullet, fast. Cuts through the clutter. Fine. Simple and elegant, right? That's what you think about when you think a simple bullet. And so we were just blown away, pleasantly surprised when people were saying, this cuts through all of that. And that's why we actually go into organizations and we say, keep your sales and marketing initiatives, infrastructures, fine. We're going to do something in parallel. And we say, okay, well, again, what is it that you want? You want revenues. All right. We guarantee that you will get more referred business, better referred business, and we actually guarantee the kinds of revenues you're going to get. Otherwise, you don't pay us. So that's risk is really low on their part. And when we compare what we do in terms of the growth versus the sales marketing machine that happens, we always blow them out of the water. Our ROI always exceeds 40 times.
Wow.
So I just...
No, you're good.
It just comes back to intentionality. It comes back to focus.
So to throw you a bit of another curveball, well, sure. let's jump back to sort of your career track, so to speak.
Okay.
So you graduate now.
Yeah.
And what do you graduate with, by the way?
Ah, okay. This is going to sound kind of lofty, but it was a master's in managing organizational change.
That's right. Okay. All right. What's your first real position in the marketplace?
This will date me. This is when there were newspaper ads in the paper for jobs. Remember that? Ads in the newspaper.
Are there not those anymore? That's a great question. I'm just going to go out and find one now. Job ads paper.
Okay. So the first paid position that wasn't sort of a side hustle, because I was working again before I left university. I was working at managing a restaurant, right? And also while at university, I was also reading business books and summarizing them for professors, which is again why I learned how vapid, how empty a lot of business books were when I could summarize it down to three lines. This is what the book says. So after university,
why would you do that for professors?
They said, Andrew, there's a lot of business books coming out. We'd like to have a quick summary. This was before, what was it called? It was a service back there. Blinkist is still around and
yeah,
does a pretty good job. And a couple of others. But at the time, people weren't getting a good sense of what was in the common business literature. And they were long books. They were expensive. And teachers or professors don't have the time necessarily to keep current. And some of them also had external consulting gigs on the side, right? So me coming in and saying, this is the latest in the literature says was worth something to them. So that was during university. But post-university, there was an ad in the paper for proposal writer at an insurance company. And because I have a dexterity in writing, I thought, that's okay. But I sent what got me the gig wasn't my writing ability. It was the insurance company had recently undergone it had recently been acquired. So it was going through a lot of change internally. And I wrote a proposal as if from the perspective of the company. And I sent it in there. And they called me within 24 hours and they said, how long have you been spying on us?
Ah.
Honestly thought. And I said, I haven't been spying on you, but I know what happens in organizations when they go through acquisition. And they said, get in here. And then I started working in the business development team. It was actually business development and marketing team, writing proposals. And this is when it was B2B proposals, where the proposals weighed in at 25 or 30 pounds, big multi-binder proposals that involved dozens and dozens of different contributors and short time frames, like a week to get in a proposal.
I'm going to sound like real ignorant here, but were these like handwritten? Were these typed? Were these?
Yeah, this was pre shared documents, right? This was anything like Google, right? So we'd do them on Word. Not everyone in the organization had a networked computer, so we'd have to print stuff out. And people would redline, subject matter experts would redline or add their comments. And then we would organize.
So how big was the proposal you sent in? And you mailed the packet.
That I sent in? Because I believe it or not, in being concise, I know you're going to find that hard to believe. It was six pages.
And you mailed it in like
a... I mailed it in.
Just a regular envelope. What kind of envelope?
Yeah, it was just a regular manila envelope. Okay. Sent it in with my name. And at the time I didn't know how to write a resume. So I didn't even write a resume. It was just sort of a cover letter saying this is a proposal about, that I think will be insightful. Send it in there, and that's when they called back. So that got me on board.
And you were proposing yourself, essentially, to.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. The reason I ask is because I feel like this is a bit of a lost art. I mean, it's referenced in like How to Win Friends and Influence People and in Think or Grow Rich. And then obviously you're referencing it now. And on occasion, rare occasion, does something kind of similar happen to me where somebody's gotten methodical of like, hey, I would like to potentially fill a role in your organization. But I feel like it's kind of a lost art, which is upsetting because, you know, especially right now, job market's a little bit tough.
Yeah.
But also the mass majority, what seems to be out there is hand-typed resumes by AI anymore for a lot of them that are just mass shot out there. Right. And then as an organization, you almost have to have a process for just skimming hundreds of resumes.
Talent management systems. Yes. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. And it's wild to me. Like every 100, you come across one that has like, they put some color in it or their headshot or something to that effect. And to give them credit, by the way, I'm not saying I necessarily did anything different. It's just for the sake of the audience and anybody that's like maybe on the job market, the moment I have a resume that just has maybe a little bit of a color and a headshot or something, right? You kind of take a momentary pause from the other ones, let alone what you're talking about, which is real intentionality of like, you know, I saw an ad and this is what it was for. And so I literally sent in my work.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in showing your stuff. I say be proud, be bold. I speak to people. I'm occasionally on Lunch Club, the platform where it introduces people to one another without an algorithm just says, hey, you'd be a good match. And it's just to meet interesting people. And as you said, the economy is such that people are looking for employment these days. And I've spoken to a number of folks, and I've suggested this to folks, and they've come back and said that this has helped them. So one of the things that I say is, listen, with the tools that are available right now, use that to demonstrate how you are different, how the value you are going to bring to an organization. In fact, demonstrate, don't talk about it. Find someone in an organization that you want to reach out to, do some background. And if you know, you can find out what some of their key pain points are, come up with a solution. Come up with a two-pager. Send it to them. Said, you know what? I've been working in your industry for X number of years. Or I've been working as this profession for X number of years. I understand your organization's going through this right now. I've done some thought. Here's what I found. Here's what I'd recommend. Here's some things that will have a major difference. Send that off to someone. And the people who are truly enlightened, the kinds of people that you would want to work for, are the ones that are going to go, wait a second, this person has some initiative. They're bright enough to be able to scan and anticipate the kinds of challenges that I want. They provided me with a solution, may not be 100% on because all organizations are different and how that's adapted or rolled out, but those are important qualities of someone that I want to hire. So the people that respond to that are the kinds of people that you want as supervisors. So do that exercise. Demonstrate value. Demonstrate value is a lot more valuable than sending a resume that tells people how you provided.
And yeah, there's Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss. Are you familiar with this book? There's the labeling is the term he uses for it, but it's really just summary, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because I was just thinking back on there are moments where you almost sound like a mind reader, but the reality is you're really just summarizing what has already been said, and then you're using your own mental summary to like, well, if that is true, then this should also be true. And then the other person's like you described perfectly in the proposal, right? You're like, they thought I was spying on them when in reality, you were like, well, this is true. So if this is true, this should also be true. And it's like, get out of our head.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a part of reflective listening and listening well. You know, we talked earlier about those key elements of trust, right? The ABCDC, the caring that is so much, so important and so often forgotten. How do you demonstrate that you care about someone? You listen to them. How do you listen to them? You reflect back to them things that you've genuinely heard. They can say, oh, you don't have that quite right, but at least you reflect back and you're validating their what they say as well as how they're feeling. Oh, this sounds like this is really important to you. This sounds like this was particularly frustrating. Doing that kind of reflection makes you more in the moment because you have to have your senses out as to not just what people are saying, but the emotion that is being carried with it. And when you reflect that back, you start to demonstrate you care, and caring is part of that building.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. That whole process actually looks like it would present more than just care. It'd show the whole ABCD, ability, believability, care, and deliverability or dependability, because, you know, you can't have, especially in the case of the proposal, you can't have the ability without literally presenting it as such. Believability, you know, you're going to be a lot more believable that you can write proposals if I'm staring at a proposal that I believe you wrote. Yeah. And then care, obviously, the depth of understanding of the business. And then, I don't know, I guess there's an argument that maybe it doesn't present dependability, but I don't know, I'd probably argue fiercely otherwise, because it's like you delivered a proposal for an open application, yeah, something tangible. You didn't have a deadline, so it's kind of hard to indicate whether or not you can stick to that or not. But I mean, man, if I don't have like a 75% certainty that you probably can handle a deadline just fine.
Yeah. Well, certainly when it comes to our, again, when it comes to the model of trust, no one action has to embody all A, B, C, sure, and D, all those things, right? It is a relationship you're building with people. So the way you engage with them, the products or offerings that you have, even your pricing, your billing, all that, every engagement helps to contribute to that trustworthiness.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important when it comes to leveraging referrals. Some people think referrals is just about introduction. Well, no, anyone can do an introduction. That's, I'm not saying that's not valuable. But when you're talking about big ticket, when doing a referral to someone can place, there's a risk for the referral source. A referral is a hearty endorsement, someone who understands that there's a fit between the organization. The benefit of a referral is you're bringing the opportunity at the bottom of the sales funnel, right? Introductions are always at the top of the funnel, and you still have to work. You still have to justify yourself. They're still looking at competitors, right? Introductions are great, but they're not the fastest path. A B2B managed referral is someone who's being brought to you when they're ready to buy. They're not even thinking about competitors anymore. And that's why it's so important to have that trust, have that systematic way of harnessing.
So, okay, we're going to have to, yeah. So I think we've gotten through a decent bit here, but I'm also worried we haven't, you know, kind of catching up to where you are now. Is there anything in particular we haven't quite hit on before we maybe move to wrap up? I know there's like a lot in your life, and we've got it condensed into like an hour, and we went into some fantastic things that I'm really glad we went into, but also don't want to make sure I've missed anything for your sake.
You know, for the time being, I'm sure we'll have other awesome conversations. For the time being, let's go through the rest of your agenda.
Yeah. Well, Yeah, that's the majority of it here. So we wrap up in two key questions.
Okay.
And they are as follows. So we have a motto here that's, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
Who's been a giant in your life that you'd like to pay homage to in this?
If I mentioned his name, he would be tremendously embarrassed. But I will use his initials, WC. And he was a supervisor when I started working at a digital marketing agency. And the reason why he was a giant, why he had such a lasting impact on me, is the way that we had our first conversation. And so there I was, a potential employee. Someone had actually introduced me to the organization, and he was the EVP sales and marketing. And we sat down, and he said, "Andrew, tell me what integrity means to you." And we spent 6 hours talking about it. So that, and you can imagine, it was the nature of the conversation went all over, right? In 6 hours, how could it not? But it was, that was the starting point, and that was the, at the end of the conversation, we had a common understanding of what, and we were aligned. We weren't, carbon copies, how old am I? And we weren't exact duplicates, but we had a complementary sense. And it meant that that was a foundation that would allow us to work together and have trust, or at least starting to have that trust. And throughout reporting into him, we had that foundation. And so there was almost a common unspoken understanding. And so that was, part of what was important in terms of integrity was being human to one another, recognizing that our individual cares and concerns and fears were just as valid, right, as anything else. And so we were able to grow the firm. The firm went gangbusters, sold it to an international firm. But it set into motion how I think about organizations, the promise that organizations have. And this, again, coming from organizational studies, you know how flawed organizations are. So that's one person.
What a beautiful way to build a foundation of trust so quickly.
So that's, I continue to learn from him today. I mentor people. I called him my mentor. So it continues. We're both ongoing learners.
The second question is, if there was a pithy saying or sort of general statement that you found to be true again and again and again in your life, what would it be?
It's sort of a variation. I'll take the sentiment. I can't remember the exact quote, but it's the sentiment that was attributed to Gandhi. And it's live every day as if it were your last, but learn every day as if you're living for it. I think that's right. And so to me, it's, you've got to recognize the preciousness of the people around you, the people with whom you work, even people who irritate you. Right? We're very blessed to be on this planet and to be working with people, sometimes people who are challenging, sometimes people who are just inspirational, but we're blessed for that. So embrace that and continue to learn. Once you stop having that curiosity, I kind of think part of you dies. I actually think that's when the brain starts to start going that way. It's just, so that's sort of a sentiment.
Beautiful. Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much for your time.
Sam, thank you. It's been a pleasure. You've taken this conversation in different directions than I ever would have imagined, and it's just been a wonderful trip. Thank you for this trip.
My pleasure. With that, I say goodbye, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.